Hello, Katie.
Okay, so I did chapter 3 in the Virtual McLuhan, From the Trivium to the Tetrad, Media as Artifact and Language.
Right.
And I chose this chapter because I had listened to the talk that you did with Youngblood and Corbin on Crowley, and you had quoted page 80 at the end of that talk. I think I keep calling it an article. And I don't even remember what the quote was on page 80. It's not very long, so you probably just read the whole last page.
Yes.
Do you remember why that was important when you guys were having that talk? It's been 2 weeks since I listened to it.
He gave the history of the Illuminati and the mystical insight from Egypt to Toronto, and the fact that this is part of a book written by Don Thiel, the fact that Don Thiel went to Toronto after New York is pretty interesting. I think it's justified, but it just shows you his profound understanding of what Marshall had discovered. McLuhan had discovered the new mystical symbolism beyond the alphabetic symbolism for what, in secret esoteric knowledge.
Okay.
He found the new. Now, you don't have your book, your copy there? Did you?
Oh, I do.
In the library?
No, well, I have
it. Go over and get it.
Okay, you want me to just read page 80?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, there's a sentence that starts on page 79. Well, I'll just read straight in there. His method of probes, of interpreting artifacts as components of a complex system, and of writing an imaginative poetic history of the evolution of the telecosm can be reinterpreted and reapplied. For example, recognizing that modernism and its aftermath constitute a prehistory of cyberspace suggests how McLuhan intuited the transformation of the book into a synesthetic hypermedia and a language composite of the entire sensory system. It is a lesson he learned, and that we can further advance by recognizing its basis in Joyce and his contemporaries, rooted in a long march from Egypt and Athens to Paris, New York, and Toronto, and by using McLuhan's method to revise McLuhan's vision. But before tracing that path further, it's important to look at aspects of McLuhan's project emanating from his early study of Nash and the days of explorations. In successive chapters, the contemporary impact of McLuhan's early fascination with journalism will be examined. Then his understanding of the historic roles in terms of power exercised by some of the literary satirists and poetic grammarians such as Pietro Arcino, Joseph Addison, and Francis Bacon, and then his specific interest in the spiritual and political power of the Hermetic and the occult, reflected in the ambivalences of angelism and robotism as they relate to what McLuhan apparently regarded as the esoteric and potentially diabolic aspect of a techno-scientific modernity.
It's quite a mouthful, that closing of that chapter.
And when I reread it, it didn't seem like that's what you guys were talking about. But anyway, we can start at the beginning of the chapter. We can talk about angelism and robotism and everything else that this chapter talks about if you want to.
Let me start at the beginning. I said I'll mute this person. Is this Rochelle 661748? Juan Wu. Don't want to say the whole name. Somebody named Juan. I guess that's not Rochelle. Okay. Let's see. Let's check the chat line. She hasn't called in. So Trey says, what was the name of the last song? That was a 60s song. That was Herb Alpert's version, This Guy's in Love with You. Famous song written by Burt Bacharach in the 60s. I'm just going to check, Katie, the last messages. What's going on here? Eliza wants Ian to come on the chat line. Linda says, some song is beautiful, don't know which one. And then Rochelle says, great way to introduce planetmedia.net. Randy Moggins interviews. Oh, yeah, I see the one that Carol and I did, or the one with me before that. A lot of people like that one. Kyle, Who, What, Where. Coleah says she's having a flashback. Rochelle says, great interviews. I was searching my archives, and these were the only ones that came up one day just when Ian came back. Then Jean screams out, I need your love. I want your love. Capital letters. Susanna says, don't let me be the last to know. And then G says, no, Kay, don't remember you flashing us last week. Susanna says, Rochelle, that's exactly where my first contact with Bob, Carol, and I was. That's the Randy Moggins interview. Kim says, me too, Susanna. And we answer Trey's point. Okay, I don't know if I want to go into the beginning of the chapter. Kate, I just want to explain that. What, McClellan?
Yeah, you're going to explain.
Let's see. Who are you, High River, Rochelle?
That's me.
Okay, good. Do we know you? Have you been on this show in any way before?
No, I'm losing my virginity tonight, Bob.
Well, how long have you prepared? How much foreplay have you done in terms of archival listening? How long?
A couple years. I've been on the docks for a couple years.
Oh, good. So you're going to be an all-nighter. If you can have that much foreplay, then you can go a long time when we all get inside
Absolutely.
Each other, right?
Absolutely.
And
hey, Bob,
are you a Canadian?
Bob, I'm going to put my headphones on and listen and knit while y'all talk.
No. Kate, we're part of
it.
What are you putting your headphones on? We're talking here, Kate.
I want to let you guys talk.
No. It's just
okay.
The beginning.
Okay. Katie. All right. I was going to knit. Anyway, okay, I was going to enjoy some knitting and just listen, but I'll talk.
No, you haven't talked in weeks. So,
I know. Okay, all right, I'll stay on.
Yeah, Rochelle had something to talk about, but we wait for that. The thing is, Rochelle, are you a Canadian?
I am.
Only Canadians think they're national identity, so note that, Rochelle. That's your first learning, first lesson. You are not a Canadian. You can't be a Canadian if you got five bodies, all right? So,
six
that's
bodies.
Your first... Very good. Yeah, it's very good. Actually, eight. But, yeah, we're working on six. Very good.
Okay.
All right. So so we're going to see what you think of what Katie and I talk about. So, Katie, you have the alphabetic, Kabbalistic symbolism in alchemy and in the occult, the esoteric wisdom, the numbers and letters.
Right.
And that's working around the phonetic alphabet. And this phonetic alphabet caused the yearning, which became known as Gnosticism, because Gnosticism yearned to get back to pure acoustic perceptual space and objected to the fragmentation that the phonetic alphabet caused. So Christianity, mm-hmm. Christianity went forward with Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas embracing visual space, and this is well explained pretty good by Northrop Frye, who I've been listening to lately, and he was a colleague of McLuhan's at University of Toronto, equally famous. But he didn't have the telegenic charisma McLuhan had, so he wasn't a raucous icon in the 60s like McLuhan was. But when they wanted to suppress mm-hmm. McLuhan in the 70s, they featured Northrop Frye doing some documentaries. He was a calmer, more like the Canadian character of being a chartered accountant, which is what Northrop Frye said, that Canadians are basically chartered accountant kind of people. So the phonetic literacy had the... Beg your pardon?
I said, meaning we're dull?
Bland, cautious, okay. And obedient, not rebellious and individualistic like Americans. You do have an eccentric individualism, McLuhan wrote, much like the South has, southern United States, you know, the Georgians and that, versus the Yankee mentality of New England. So there's a subtlety where... Canadians have an eccentric individualism, but they're not against bureaucratic governmental bureaucracy like Canadians are. Canadians accept bureaucracy more than Americans. So that's what we call individualism.
Yeah, but Canadian INS are nothing like that.
Canadian INS? Do we know any, Carolyn? Rochelle becoming partisan already.
I'm not a Canadian. I'm a human
being. That's a Canadian response. Hey, yay, Carolyn, see, looking for support.
Well, look at number one, Chad, Sasha, Wendy, Sue. Connie, Rochelle. Look at them all.
Well, Rochelle, we haven't found out about her yet. She could be faking this whole setup. She could be RCMP intelligence.
My British friends tell me that I'm not a dull Canadian. They like that.
Well, you're here. That's
a good sign.
Good sign that you're on that eccentricity. Yes, that's good.
Well, from accountants, Bob, we also create a lot of good comedians.
No, that's true. Yes, the sense of humor. And you know why that is? Because Canadians are contemplative up against the American media juggernaut. So they're forced to be in a contemplative mood, but they're the most familiar with the American dynamism because they live right beside it. So that makes them be in interval, which evokes humor. So that's the explanation.
I think it's also because we're in between American sensibilities and British sensibilities.
Yes, we're
so,
in the interval.
So we're observing both.
Yes, and that's
makes
a good way to do it.
More contemplative.
We are the borderline case.
We see the flaws in both. We're able to be a little bit detached and see how stupid they all are.
Yeah, they all are. That's right. That's why McLuhan said the Canadians have a superiority complex, very quiet superiority complex. They don't engage. They don't even notice anything that everybody else is yelling about. But whereas Americans grow up in the middle of it. They're on the spot. They're the country been on the spot since World War II. They're in charge of everything. They're the cops, and they got to deal with the headaches of it. Canadians sort of bask in the affluence of it without the headaches. It's like Bob and Connie. It's a Bob and Connie archetype. Black.
Someone describes Canada than the U.S. is that, Canada's the same prison. We just have nicer bedding and pillows.
Yes, that's right. We have the security. Well, not so much we anymore. Karen and I haven't been there in a long time, but... Canadians have the, like Dave Worster once said to me, well, Bob, I'm sitting on a cement floor and you're sitting on the same floor but on a pillow. So that's true. Canadians have that extra security, which is going to ruin them in the long run, according to ION. They're just too used to being protected, and there's no room to be protected anymore. So we're here to toughen up the Canadian as well as soften up the American.
There you go.
We are the solar government. We are in the interval between the four bodies, six bodies if you're smart. Okay, so back to Katie. So you have this reaction to the phonetic alphabet. Go forward with Catholic Thomism, and or go back. So then you have the movement of the secret of these two external, exoteric wisdom and esoteric wisdom through what's he say? Egypt, Rome.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What's the next one? Rome.
It is Egypt, Britain. Athens, Paris, New York, Toronto.
Oh, okay. So he's doing the more of the esoteric, not the exoteric, which goes through the Catholic Church. That's Rome. So yeah, you got Egypt, Greece, Athens, Paris.
Mm-hmm.
And then is there
New York?
Britain? Doesn't go to London, eh? Well, that would be the, because they're a religion too. They're the exoteric, the Catholic Church. And then you go to New York. Now, who would ever think you would then go to Toronto? Nobody knows that. Many people still go or did go to New York before 9/11 as the secret initiatory ritual. It was the Big Apple, the Android meme, and the extremists. And no one knew that there was a new kind of esoteric wisdom coming out of Toronto, which was not limited to the effects reacting or proactive around the phonetic alphabet, but looking at what Don Field calls the telecosm, the new media landscapes that were replacing the nature that Gnostics were trying to retrieve, you know, the tribal acoustic space, the buzzing confusion, even contact with the real astral body. So you have this simulation that's all around us, and McLuhan turned that into a mystical symbolism, and that's why there's 33 chapters in Understanding Media. That's the 33 levels of Freemasonry as symbolic, but he's using the environments that radio created as opposed to what movies and automobiles created and the television and computer environments. They all become symbolic of what the Kabbalah used to mean.
And the 33rd parallel. But, hey, Bob, do you think that Toronto, there's a layer of all the draft Dodgers who came to Canada. Most of them would have come to Toronto and created some sort of Americanism there.
No, they didn't. they were assimilated. And
really?
Many of them went back home. Went back once the amnesty came in with, I think, President Ford in the mid-70s. But, no, nobody even knows. It's not Toronto the environment. It's not Toronto the city. It is the intellectual polarity of Northrop Frye versus Marsh McLuhan, which is the secret wisdom. And Bruce Powell has now just written a book on it. Marsh McLuhan and Bruce and Northrop Frye, subtitled Apocalypse and Alchemy. Now, those are pretty dramatic titles for English teachers. That's what McLuhan and Frye were.
Mm-hmm.
They were English
teachers. So McLuhan was the apocalypse?
They both were. That's what Bruce Powell is trying to show, their overlapping and similarity, even though on the surface they're very different. Their chemical bodies are very different.
But remember, you talk a lot about McLuhan in the Trade Towers saying the word apocalyptic.
Yes. Well, they both talked about apocalypse. Now, if you listen to, we posted the Northrop Frye series on Dukes, and if you start to listen to that, it's a great thing to bounce off what we learned from Ion in the Revelation series. So, for example, we would have, here's a statement by Northrop Frye. Now, he is a Methodist, Baptist, something minister, Protestant, but not Anglican. He's the more, whatever, proletarian ones. So he's a minister, but he's an intellectual. So he gave up being a preacher, I think. He might have done a little bit in the local, churches, but he became almost a heretic. He regarded the Bible as literature and showed it to be the great code understanding all the classics of the Western literature tradition. But here's the kind of statements he makes in these lectures. He says, the primitive conception of wisdom is the permeation of the individual life by the communal tradition and prudence. But there are different degrees of absorption of that, and complete absorption comes at the point of complete spontaneity. That is why I said, this is what Northrop Frye says, that is why I said that the figure of wisdom in the Bible suggests a little girl with the skipping rope, and why Jesus places a child in the middle of his disciples, not as a symbol of uncritical intelligence, but as a symbol of genuine wisdom, where the absorption has gone to the point of complete spontaneity. There are many Eastern religions, like Taoism in China and some aspects of Zen Buddhism, that also stress the recovery of the child's spontaneity. That complete integrity of the rhythm of thinking and of doing is the goal of what they are teaching. In practically all of our ordinary life, action comes first, and thinking about the action comes a second or two later, as in T.S. Eliot's poem, The Hollow Men, where the shadow falls between the idea and the response. That split second of time between acting and thinking about acting, that split second of time between acting and thinking about acting is part of what is meant, in Christianity at least, by the fall. It's the shadow thrown over life that is bound up with the passing of time, and that makes it so difficult for us to live the purely spontaneous life, exhorted or urged by the Sermon on the Mount, where the comparison is drawn with the lilies of the field. Then Frye says, I think that in St. Paul's argument, one works for a further end in view, but that is not the central thing that he's talking about, because that becomes a kind of donkey's carrot. You chase a retreating goal and eventually find that the means don't lead to the end because the means replace the end, and eventually you lose sight of the end. Certainly some of the things that the New Testament means by faith correspond to what the book of Proverbs means by wisdom. It's the same integrity of action and reflection on the action. The process no longer schizophrenic, but the activity of a conscious being. That is why the book of Proverbs says, quote, I dwell with prudence and find out knowledge of witty inventions, unquote. That's like knowing the effects of technologies. Then Frye says, I think the sound of that in English is right. I don't know how close it is to the Hebrew, but the sense of creativity is, I think, included in the whole conception of wisdom. Now, that's not what you normally get from a Baptist minister, do you, Katie?
No, not at all.
It's pretty profound what he's saying.
Mm-hmm. And you could substitute that word prudence with ion, too, and reread that sentence. That would be interesting.
Yes. As a matter of fact, I'm going to ask Ion about that. So you have Northrop Frye. He's tactile, but he has a visual bias. And McLuhan's tactile with a non-bias. So if you look at the direction of Christianity towards visual space and the services of visual space, the phonetic alphabet and the printed book, Fry is more there, whereas McLuhan can be aligned with the Gnostics and the post-Gnostics and then into a whole new telecosm. But then you have Fry say this. He says, there was a time when we went to school to learn the three R's, but now we go to learn the three A's. Do you know what the three A's are, Carolyn?
Art.
One, maybe. No,
art,
you don't
alchemy.
Know.
Aestheticism.
That's art.
Acquisition.
Okay, so there's Carolyn. So you got three, Katie?
No, I have zero.
Okay, three A's, anxiety, absurdity, and alienation. That's what you learn in college. That's a professor who's seen a lot of students. I know. And he's seen a lot of students, right, for 40, 50 years. And he sees that that's what you learn, not the three R's, but you learn the three A's. So then he says, that is the primer of 20th century man. If a person knows the meaning of those three words, he knows all the wisdom that the 20th century can teach him. Anxiety, absurdity, and alienation, which God knows is little enough. Not enough, says Northrop. Anyway, the author of Ecclesiastes is aware of all these three A's, and he tells you how to get through them. Most of it, of course, consists simply of ignoring them, but there are other things to do as well. I think I've said before in commenting on the imagery of the Bible that in the Bible, as in other works, you find the world divided between visible and invisible reality. There's Ion. What is visible is not real. What's invisible is real. So you find in the Bible the world divided between visible and invisible reality. There are many thinkers for whom the invisible world forms an order of reality superior to that of the visible world. In commenting on creation, I've suggested, says Fry, that while the Bible recognizes an invisible world, it doesn't think of it as a superior order of reality. That's a bit different from Ion. But the point is, now note this. See, he's going to celebrate the visible or not make it inferior. It thinks, the Bible thinks of the invisible world rather as the means by which the world becomes visible. Think of that, Carol. Hidden ground and then you get a figure. Invisible is hidden ground and the figure is visible. That is, if you start to think of things that you can't see but know to exist, the first thing you might think of is the air. Now here's something you never heard of, Carol. You can't see the air because if you did, you could see nothing else. Now, you've never heard, none of you ever heard that idea before, right, Katie?
No, I've never heard that idea before.
Yeah, if you can see, the air is invisible. If you could see the air, you'd see nothing else. And so because the air is invisible, we can see everything else. So he says, if you could see the air, you would be living in a dense fog or mist, which is one of the metaphorical meanings of this word vanity. He's talking about the phrase vanity of vanities in Ecclesiastes. You can't see the air because it's being invisible enables you to see what is not air. In the account of creation at the beginning of Genesis, the first things created are light and the firmament. That is the basis of vision and sound. Now, Ion says firmament is defined as people, crowd of people. So is that sound? Because there is a sense in which you don't see light either. You see a source or reflection of light. How's this going with you, Rochelle? Are you still with us?
I'm getting it.
Okay. Thus, when the author of Ecclesiastes speaks of vanity, he has in mind a conception rather like what some Oriental religions are talking about when they speak of the void. Shunyata, I think, is the Buddhist term. That is, everything is there, but everything is in nothingness. The objective world is neither there nor not there. It is rather a force that man has got lost in, and his schedule of behavior is connected with finding a way out of it. If he is oppressed by the objectivity, by the there-ness of the force, he will find himself tramping around in a circle, which is an inevitable symbol of lost direction. So a circle is a symbol of lost direction. If, on the other hand, he assumes that the forest is not there, he will very soon find himself bumping into trees. So to find a way out, you have to steer a middle course. There is something in the forest which is there and something which is not there. When you find a wedge between those two things, you've started to find your way out. So he's talking about the interval, but with a visual bias. But isn't that pretty clever, eh?
It is.
Yeah.
So And the Christian vision is that you're neither in this world or of other worlds. You're nowhere. You're here, there. You're in this world, and you use this world to see the other world, and you use the other world to see this world. See the interplay? That's A is to B, mm-hmm. and C is to D. Metaphor, everything's metaphorical of itself and the other. So then he says, that, I think, is what the author of Ecclesiastes means primarily by vanity. It means that he is abandoning all the things that I've called donkey's carrots. For one thing, the value judgment that wisdom is better than folly. So you're going to abandon that. Ecclesiastes says that he decided that wisdom was better than folly. Then he found that that was vanity, because the wise man and the fool both die, so there's no advantage in wisdom. And there's a quote, "Then said I to myself, this also is vanity," unquote. That is, once you stop with the notion that there's no difference between wisdom and folly, you're as bad a muddle as you are when you assume that there is a difference. If I could give an example of what it's meant here, says Fry, we may say of the village saint and the village sinner in a small community that the saint is the better man than the sinner, and that all our moral standards would collapse into chaos unless we assumed that the saint was the better man than the sinner, and that if they were both threatened with peril or disaster, the saint would be the more important man to save, or woman to save, or dog. That's all right, except that I'm adding the dog woman part. That's all right. So, okay, so we'd say that we would save the sinner, the saint, before the sinner. That's all right, except that the saint himself would be very unlikely to take such a view and would certainly, in a crisis, be more likely to try to save the sinner than to save himself. Isn't that great? Yep. Consequently, the axiom of his behavior is not at all that sanctity is better than sinning. He has got to a position where this and this not are equally meaningless. That's the wise person. That is the saint. That is the basis of the ethic of the book of Ecclesiastes, which is very close to that of the Sermon on the Mount. So I thought we'd read that into the record. It's very, very good insight by Mr. Fry. Now, does that lead you to say anything, Katie or Rochelle, about anything?
It's actually similar to this chapter that I had prepared, because this chapter talks about how Marshall's prose is so different than the poetic style that he wrote in his other work, and how he was writing it mysteriously on purpose.
Yes, he was writing the new symbolism. His
mm-hmm.
books are not his opinion, not his knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
They're his perception of the new environments as the new Kabbalah, the new path to breakthrough, which becomes breakdown, which then flips into breakthrough.
Let me read this quote about what he says about his work, okay?
Okay, all right.
"I would be grateful to you if you could give me examples where I have misstated any fact whatever. My canvases are surrealist, and to call them theories is to miss my satirical intent altogether. As you will find in my literary essays, I can write the ordinary kind of prose any time I choose to do so. You are in great need of some intense training and perceptions in the art."
Right, that's a letter to William Koons. That's a letter to William
mm-hmm.
Koons, who was tried to write a biography of McLuhan, but I think he got rejected by Mrs. McLuhan eventually. That was in the 90s, late 80s, early 90s. But that's a letter about 1971 or so, and Koons had written a book on Bucky Fuller, all the big heavy minds of the 60s, including McLuhan. And McLuhan said his essay on McLuhan was ridiculous. He had no clue, because he was looking at McLuhan as a theoretician. And Marshall's saying, "I don't deal with theories." He says, "I write satirically, surrealistically, but it also includes the arrow of time and straightforward writing, like a scientist, and categorizing." So he's not just a satirist. He actually has something that's worth knowing.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of his vision. You were going to
mm-hmm.
say something?
It seems like in this chapter, too, this is the first time I'm hearing or reading about Marshall being exposed to Joyce, and he had a change of heart about his Thomism, too, and moved away from that. No, yes, what do you think of that?
Yeah, well, McLuhan moved away from everything. There's a good McLuhan scholar named Gerald O'Grady, and at that conference in 1998 at Lincoln Center, everybody came out, and there was 45 professorial speakers, and they all said McLuhan was influenced by this or that. But Gerald O'Grady says, "I have just been in Ottawa, spent a year or two looking at Marshall's archive, that I helped organize personally back in 81. And so this is 17 years later. O'Grady is in Ottawa living there. He told me later, lived there for 2 years, reading all the letters and documents and essays by McLuhan. And he said, if you do that, you will realize that Marshall wasn't influenced by anybody. And Ian would agree with that, because Ian said very early McLuhan started parallel worlding and got some insights from other worlds so that he wouldn't be influenced anybody, and that he actually put on the whole Western intellectual tradition. So McLuhan, so Grady says nobody influenced McLuhan. So what you see, and this is what I show in my tiny note chart, is the way McLuhan, as a quadriphenic, that means put on schizophrenia and then mime the android meme schizophrenia. So you get two schizophrenias, and that makes four parts. He juggles Wyndham Lewis, T.S. Eliot, Ezra Pound, James Joyce, and some W.B. Yeats. He juggles these guys depending on who he's talking to. So when he's around a lot of Joyceans, he'll emphasize Wyndham Lewis. When he's around the Wyndham Lewis gang, he'll emphasize Joyce or Pound. And it's the juggling of that that is the doctrine of analogical proportionality. A is to B, is C is to D, or figure, ground, what's the context? The ground is the context, the figure is what you're working with or what seems to be visible. So then McLuhan saw that the tetrad managers, the intelligence agencies, managed the media environments before they got digitized in the first two-thirds of the 20th century, managed them like McLuhan managed Joyce, Lewis, Yeats, and Pound, and Eliot. They juggled them. So there never was going to be a collapse of the economy, but they would use software, radio and TV, to a post-moneyed world, a software communist world, to threaten visual space and the accounting that the bankers were doing, but never totally could wipe out visual space. Because once a medium is made, it can't be disappeared. So the juggling... So the population ran around taking sides about whether inflation was good, inflation was bad, stagflation was terrible, or should we create a new economy, should we go communist, should we go libertarian? All these positions that the citizen took was the illusion that the tetrad manager exploited. So that's the new mysticism. The new magic is the tetrad managers playing with the radio environment, the TV environment, knowing their particular effects, and having them run their courses on the populations, and then flipping back in the newspapers, then movies, then automobiles, and big ships, and bombs, and space, satellite stuff, and computers, juggling those until Ion showed up, and we cleared up that fucking nonsense, right?
Yep.
Yeah, but after that point, we are talking, the point of Bob knowledge is to understand the symmetry and poetry of the past, especially the last 150 years under the electronic dynamo, under electricity. That's the to delight your mind. So just as Christianity adopts visual space as a counter to acoustic chaos and tactile spontaneity, we adopt the mind and its imagery in the new symbolism of the new alchemy as a playful anti-environment to numbnuts who don't have anything to say. See? We're here to talk. Not trapped in any talking, but here to seduce new Canadians like Rochelle with our charisma.
So true.
So next point you want to make...
Well, then a couple of
Right, someone else saying something, yes? Rochelle, you were saying something? Oh, okay.
No, go ahead, because we'll move on from this point. Seriously, what were you going to say?
Well, McLuhan, when he was relating to other people, I mean, he was the master of the advertising techniques. That's what you do to sell your audience. You relate to something that they're familiar with.
That's right. In the analog media phase, before the android meme, listen to this, Rochelle.
Yeah, that,
you got an important point, but let me tell you something you don't know about it. In the analog media period, say 1850 to 1980, McLuhan says that after 1922, advertising is the only legitimate art form. That Ezra Pound and some of the artists got in trouble because they kept trying to do the old Gutenberg arts, poetry, sculpture, music, painting and these things, whereas the new art was advertising, and advertising was using the techniques discovered by these radical modernists, Lewis, Pound, Eliot, and Joyce. So advertising was the art form. It was a collective art form. So what was the anti-environment or the Menippean satire of advertising? How do you create an anti-environment, which is the role of the artist? You wouldn't use the old arts and sciences. You would be a journalist or run a TV show like 60 Minutes. It was news that was the Menippean satire of advertising. All right, so there's something you wouldn't have said, but I assume you immediately understood it once you heard it.
I did. And what I was going to say further, I think what was interesting about McLuhan, it seemed to me that he was in a category of his own. He became more interested with questions than answers. You know, so
yes,
he had answers, but he was constantly searching.
If you ever look at his letters, go to page, well, I don't know the page number right off, but you go to the letter June 22nd, 1951, where he writes a long letter to Ezra Pound talking about how he's an intellectual thug. And he says, and this is just as Mechanical Bride came out in early 51, he says, I am going to I'm going to create an operation on the sidelines. He knew he'd be not, you know, hugely big like the Beatles. He wouldn't have merged enough with the contemporary perfect pitch to be that, and he wasn't a musician. So he said, I'm going to be on the sidelines, so I'm going to create a disturbance to distract the triggermen. The triggermen were the CIA, the James Bonds, the intelligence agencies, which he knew were the tetra managers. So he's going to create a put-on to distract the triggermen, but also it will serve to needle the somnambulist, which is the average citizen who had no clue what was going on any level. So what you just said, I'm refining his put-on. He put on the Big Brother, the secret part of society, and he put on the average guy enjoying hockey. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. I do.
So what did you say that made me say that? You said something that was
good. Well, I was talking about how he was constantly striving. A lot of philosophers or you know, people that are coming in that area, they find their theme and they stick with it. You know, he was constantly challenging what he was thinking. He was constantly.
So you're saying he didn't find a theme and stick with it. He didn't do that. Is that what you're saying?
Well, don't you think that it kept evolving as he did? That his theory.
He was doing all five methods. He had a theme. He was a Catholic Thomist with a little Gnosticism thrown in. And that's why Don Thiel says that McLuhan was schizoid. Not schizophrenic, but schizoid. He was working on two levels all the time. So he was doing that. And so he had a constancy to his method, but he was adjusting to whatever the present fads were and creating any environments to the fads. And he would change his models or what appeared to be concepts, every 3 or 4 years. So he wasn't holding to some, like Heidegger, holding to some being and nothingness concepts and then sticking and trying to explain them and maybe making one big insight later in his life and changing slightly. McLuhan said change was the only stability, and he always quoted Wyndham Lewis's doctrine of not oneness but two-ness, that one must change completely their direction in mid-career. And many people thought McLuhan did that when he dropped the content analysis of Mechanical Bride and went into formal analysis of understanding media, and he seemed to embrace all that he was criticizing before. So it appeared to be a two-ness, that he had reversed direction and became a hypocrite or, you know, sold out. But McLuhan was not in the writing of the medium as the message and understanding media. There was no McLuhan in there. He had removed himself even more than he had in Mechanical Bride. Now, you seem to talk about McLuhan as if you know about him. Have you read him? Is he part of your education or something?
Yeah, I spent a lot of time in Toronto, and I have friends in advertising, so you come across it over the years, for sure.
Yeah,
I certainly
yeah.
haven't read him as well as you have, Bob. No one has.
No one has what?
No one has read McLuhan as well as you have.
No, I haven't, and you will see that in my new dialogues with Derek DeKirchhoff. You ever heard of him?
No.
Yeah, he is the Belgium. I guess he became a Canadian, Belgian Canadian, and he He became a student of McLuhan's in the early 70s, late 60s, early 70s, and he translated from cliché to archetype into French. But okay. He was a French professor at the Catholic part, St. Michael's College, and he basically took over the center after McLuhan died. And first with David Olson, but Olson quit eventually, and Derek. So Derek has been the one that the major media go to when they want to get a replay of McLuhan or a taste of McLuhan. So they go for him and not me, but circumstances led to us getting together on the phone, and we're now starting a series. And it's pretty good because you're getting two experts on McLuhan who've had a lot of experience with all kinds of people. He having the advantage of meeting people through his McLuhan image and me from my own past. So that's the new level of dialogue you can start to hear. Me and the Kirkhoff, we're going to do a series. But back to your, so that's pretty good. Your new friends in advertising. So, Katie, what do you say at this point?
Well, I want to just talk about the mechanical bride for a second since we were talking about that a minute ago and finish up. That was an example of that four-part structure. So that was the Tetrad management as an art form, as a book, using bits and pieces of all of advertising, comic strips, all of the new art.
The four levels, you're talking about the four levels on a page of Mechanical Bride.
Right. The four parts operate in a kind of counterpoint, implying more than is said, is what John said about the book. And then it was interesting, he also mentioned that McLuhan moved away from the overt moralism of the bride. And that was the first I'd even considered that, but you do notice that that book is very moral.
Well, it's critical. He seems to be offering. He says there's something that we're being deluded by, and this is not good. You know, the kids don't have an up-to-date education about what the media is doing to them, and the parents don't understand it. And he's taking a position that this is negative. This is not good for a Christian society. Well, that's what happens, 10 years later when he puts out Gutenberg Galaxy and Understanding Media. He seems to have dropped his moral stance because people
think that...
And then he's
more objective.
Right, but they think that he is writing those books and they represent his opinion, but he's not being moralistic in the later books. Well, the point is there's no Marshall in Understanding Media.
Mm-hmm.
When I organized his archives, I found a note that he had with the first copy of Understanding Media, the printout, the off prints, what do they call them? They have some term they call it, where the publisher sends the guy and he checks out what the mistakes and all that, the fool's cap and whatever.
The galley proof? The galley proof?
Yeah, the galleys and the proofs, right. And so he had a note on the final galley proof, and he said, this book is about the archetype of speech responding to the media cliche probes of the global theater. In other words, the new media environment. So it's speech speaking, not a human being, not someone with value or semantic meaning in his words. That's why many people find McLuhan's writing dry and technical, because it's speech responding to the charge that it is the flower of evil, and it's saying, well, what about these newer post-verbal media that are creating cloning? Right. And clone. So and you know how we know this? Is that McLuhan wrote a play in the late 50s where he had each medium that he later inventoried in Understanding Media in 1964 be an actor in the play. And they would come out and defend themselves like Greek gods or Greek Olympians. So he had these media acting out and defending their turf in a theatrical presentation on Broadway. That was the hope to do this, never got done. And that's why you know that Understanding Media is the script of that play. And it's because it's the book medium in the end, because you can make Understanding Media into other media, present as a TV show or any other form, a movie. But since it's in book form, it is speech, which is the content of print, hijacking all the other media in the global theater and saying, no, this is the way it is, and this is my bias, and this is what I stand for. It's not Marshall. And that's why it hasn't got any morality in it. It's the technical environment of speech responding. Now, that's pretty avant-garde. That's pretty advanced esoteric alchemy to do that.
It really is.
Of course, and no one knows this, only me and Don Thiel. That's why Don Thiel begins his book with me.
And now we know.
And made Typographic Man.
What about Typographic Man?
And the made Typographic Man.
Well, that's the subtitle of the group. Well, wait, but that's the subtitle of the Gutenberg Galaxy, the book before Understanding Media. So why, what made? And I'm not sure if you've got a noun or verb or object.
The made. The made. You said you were the only one and one other was the only one. There's also another. The made Typographic Man also is one.
Do you mean like made as in the mafia? A made man?
Yes.
Well, that would be the bankers. They're the one, or the secret intelligence agencies that maintain visual space so that Katie can be Katie and Rochelle can be Rochelle and the names can't be switched. You know, the visual private identity is what the intelligence agencies hoik up. That's what they mean when they say, you guys can go and play with Bob on the radio, but we're out here fighting the Al-Qaeda and defending your way of life. I'm thinking that's what you mean, Ion, about the made Gutenberg man?
Well, if you were making, if that's what it's supposed to do, is making this particular man, the made one would also know what you know. So you're made, you're the made typographical man, Bob.
I'm the made what? That was the next word? Archetypal? You said another, you heard those syllables, right, Katie? Don't let him get away with it. He said made, blah, 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 man. What was it?
Yeah, made.
Typographic man.
Oh, typographic. All right, made typographic man. Yes, we put on visual space here because we're largely talking to that environment. And we feature Katie, who wants to be a writer, but is forced to go TV.
Well, now I'm over at books completely now. I'm writing screenplay. It's so much more fun. So much more fun.
Okay, well, is there any else that you want to... So you see the importance of that statement on page 80 of Don's book, came out in 2001, The Virtual Marshall McLuhan, of the esoteric
wisdom. There's a word here that I didn't know what it meant, too. That, can I ask you what this word is?
Yeah.
It's visual kind. Visual hyphen K-I-N-E.
I think that means cinema. Visual kinetic. It's an old version of kinema, of cinema. So it might be silent movies would be
kinescope,
visual kinetic.
Okay.
Yeah, kinescope.
All right, let me... Okay, then I just want to talk about one more little paragraph on here, especially since Ion's here. The next paragraph I loved because it tied in... the tube, the TV tube.
Yeah.
And you know I love that motif. So I'm going to read this paragraph. Another factor that McLuhan attributed from time to time to the elements of such transformations is the distinction between media which invite participation, TV as a cool medium, and those which do not, film as a hot medium. In the case of TV and film, he relates this to the way the light was projected to create the images. Film projects light on the screen, TV projected light through the tube. TV then could be compared to the stained glass where the window is illuminated by the light coming through it. And we've talked about that stained glass window analogy before, but I've never heard it with relation to the TV and the TV tube.
Yes,
anything
the
more
TV
to say about
is light
that,
through.
Bob?
Yeah, the television glows. The light comes through the cathode of the old TV. It would come through the cathode ray tube, and it was pure electricity, in which you don't know where it begins or ends. So it goes right into your gut and into your eyeballs and your ears. So you become the screen, whereas the previous environment of movie watching, the light was thrown from behind you, bounced off the wall, just like light bouncing off a book page, and then enters your eye and ears. So the bouncing effect... That's one step removed. That's not direct X-ray. So the movies were still slightly print-oriented, or what is it called, a detaching hot medium, whereas the surround and light through, like stained glass windows, of television was cool and involving, and you didn't have any perspective.
Is it the light, too, that produces the synesthesia?
Yes. Well, you know, you could get into brain science, and neurosurgeons would say different things, but in general concepts, the mixing of the media happens with light through because there is no beginning or ending point, like Ion talks about. There's no solid wall that the light is bouncing off of, like with the book page or the movie screen. There's no bounce. It's just through you. And so when that came in the 1560s, people instinctively, responding to new sensory ratios, the new tactile and synesthetic ratios, immediately started taking drugs, psychedelic, psychoactive drugs, because they create the light through experience. The stained glass experience. So you see that the fads are responding to the hidden effect of a general medium that has come in, the medium of television.
Con is the plural of cow.
What is?
Con.
C-O-N?
K-I-N-E.
The
plural of cow.
C-O-W.
Kind is a plural of cow?
Yes.
How does that relate to what we're talking about here? Because it turns us into a bird? A herd of cow?
You didn't know what the word meant, we're telling you.
Okay, so does that have anything to do with how TV turns us in? No. Okay. That's fine.
The dictionary defines it as.
Yeah. So this is actually stuff that no one's ever heard when McLuhan first started presenting this. Now, he worked this out with Ted Carpenter, Don Thiel, Walter Ong, and a few other colleagues. And so when he got his tenure in 1952, the same year Harold Innes died, and he was able to take Innes immediately and prop up Innes, who had a big, famous academic reputation. So here's McLuhan, the upstart, going to take Innes and claim that he's a footnote to Innes, put on the establishment and say, I'm just developing Innes. But Innes, a year after he died, McLuhan reviewed one of his books, probably the Bias of Communication, and said that Innes had no knowledge of the arts and sciences, meaning Joyce, Pound, Lewis, and Eliot, and Yeats. He had no understanding of that, and actually was not so smart about media. So here he is putting down Innes, but 10 years later he's saying in public that all of his writings are a footnote to Innes. So that's the put-on. He's putting on the establishment. That meant that he could get a Governor General's award. But he's really still an intellectual thug, infiltrating decent society. He put decent in quotes. And so in 52, when he gets his tenure, which means you can't be fired, that's the way it was back then, and they later tried to take away his tenure in the 70s, which is unheard of in academia, but they tried it. They were so upset by McLuhan. But anyways, in 52, he immediately starts doing his media analysis about TV and the difference between that and movies and books. Just popped it out of, and there was no indication of that really in his writings before that. Little sneaky things put in here, but he suddenly bursts out once he's got tenure and Innes is gone. So this this is what the famous American critic Harold Bloom called the anxiety of influence, that if you go through the history of literature or art, the new guys are always up against the greats of the previous generations, and they purposely misinterpret the greats so they can make room for themselves and coming up a different take. It's called the anxiety of influence. Well, McLuhan put on the anxiety of influence in his relationship with Innes. But it turned out that Harold Innes was very influenced by Wyndham Lewis. And Wyndham Lewis had an incredible influence on McLuhan. So it turns out that Wyndham Lewis is the great mind from the first half of the 20th century that is still suppressed up till a couple of years ago when British Tate Museums and the big museums started doing retrospectives on Lewis, but it took this long. So we always go back to Wyndham Lewis and his argument with James Joyce. So then Don Thiel, in his first book of McLuhan called The Medium is a Rearview Mirror in 1971, he points out that McLuhan was a closet Lewisite putting on James Joyce and Finnegan's Wake. Hoiking up Finnegan's Wake is more appropriate on the surface example of synesthesia in the book form, but was actually doing it on behalf of Lewis. Now, that's a pretty controversial statement, because I'm saying that McLuhan was not Lewis, not Joyce, none of them. And Theo and I used to argue and discuss this. But in the end, Don, as a lapsed Catholic, wanting to move towards maybe the esoteric or a new world. He'd be pro-Ion. Don was pro-Ion, and he actually engaged with the Evergreens. And this is the president of a university, so they don't talk about that too much. But he said McLuhan, in the end, was a reactionary and was a Catholic and working towards morality and what Ion would not be so suggestive and supportive of right now. I think Ion would back in the old days, but not now because it doesn't work today. When we got five bodies, morals and value judgments just fall apart and just get in the way of understanding what's happening. So Don Thiel said that Marshall used James Joyce and undermined James Joyce in the long run. So Thiel's agenda in the 90s was to retrieve Finnegan's Wake, start over again, because Marshall said all his work was a translation of Finnegan's Wake, but not be through the distorted glass of McLuhan's bias. So that's the final critical stance that Thiel takes. And it's interesting for a really good knowledge of McLuhan to understand the points Thiel makes at the end of his 1971 book, but it's not relevant today. We can't even make McLuhan relevant today. It's been all superseded. But when we engage the mind, we discuss these past worlds as if they're past, and that's the argument. So you're gonna find out that Thiel points out to you that McLuhan is saying the mechanical bride is moralistic, and he later drops the moralistic stance. But Thiel knows that McLuhan didn't really. So that's the confusion we end up with, and we can drop it and go on to other topics. Unless you have something extra. I mean, see, the fun is learning, is your mind engaging and seeing patterns. So you engage new patterns by rereading that chapter and seeing something that you hadn't seen about Mechanical Bride before. So that's an aesthetic delight.
There are a couple other things, but since Ion's here, let's move on. And if we feel like we want to come back to this, we will.
Okay.